Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Okay, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to talk about evolution by natural selection, especially about what natural selection itself explains. And the starting point will be a distinction between two roles that selection might have, two things that it might explain. And this is a distinction between an easy case and a hard case, a role that selection has which is uncontroversial and a further role that is controversial. And roughly, this has to do with the difference between explaining where new things come from and explaining what happens to them once they exist. So the controversial part is the idea that natural selection has an essential role in explaining the origination of things, the coming into being of new kinds of organisms with new traits. And I'll use a terminology that distinguishes between origin explanations and distribution explanations, where the former concern the appearance of new things and the latter concern what happens to them once they exist. So debate about origin explanations, debate about what I'm calling origin explanations, began very soon after Darwin and has continued to the present. Not only opponents, but also some strong defenders of Darwinism think it is misguided to see selection itself as a creative force in the world. There's less debate about the role of selection in distribution explanations, explanations of what happens to things once they exist. So even creationists often say that natural selection can certainly shuffle things around, but can't create anything new. Jerry Fodor, in articles and in his book with Piattelli Palmarini, argues that there is a problem with the apparent role of natural selection in distribution explanations. In particular, explanations of why a trait survived and spread. So it's said that it's not possible to say that something happened because trait T1 was selected for, rather than it being because trait 2 was selected for, in a case where organisms that have T1 also have T2. Now, I and others have replied that natural selection is a causal process. The theory of natural selection is a theory of how the accumulation of many small and ordinary causal sequences can have large-scale effects. So there's no problem at all in saying that even if the successful organisms have both T1 and T2, it can be T1 that made them do well, helped them to survive and reproduce, while T2 had no effect at all. So, for example, suppose that T1 is the exterior colour of some organism, and trait T2, which is correlated with it, is the colour of some internal structure which is never normally seen. So one trait mattered in the organism's dealing with predators and other factors, and the other did not. If that's so, then T1 was selected for. Nothing else is needed. Fodor has replied that these causal distinctions I'm making are not available unless we can come up with a special kind of law of nature that captures them, what he calls a law of selection as such. Why should we believe this? Evolutionary theory is full of causal generalizations, of course, like the rest of biology. It is true that people usually do not write down things we might call laws of selection as such. The same is true of the rest of biology. And here I have in mind the entire expanse of the field, pretty much, molecular biology, immunology, developmental biology, and so on. It's a philosophically interesting fact that biology does not have much of a role for laws. Nonetheless, biology was undoubtedly the most rapidly progressing part of science during the last 60 years. The deluge of information and understanding that resulted during that period was not slowed down or compromised by the biologists' preferred organization of knowledge in terms of models and descriptions of causal mechanisms instead of laws. Certainly not laws in Fodor's very philosophically constricted sense. Evolutionary biology, including the theory of natural selection, is done in the same style. In this paper, I'm not going to be concerned with those details about distribution explanations.
Instead, I want to look at the harder case, origin explanation. So what I'll do is I'll put some older and some newer debates into a single framework and argue for a positive view about the role of selection in origin explanations. Okay, the theme of this conference is debating Darwin. And Fodor, in his title, refers to the Darwin Wars. Outside of the context of creationism and the intelligent design movement, the only war here is a manufactured one. There are many live debates, but in the same sense in which there are quantum mechanics debates rather than quantum mechanics wars, we have debates about natural selection rather than a war. The prevalence of creationist attitudes is another matter, so I distinguish that debate from what we're involved with here. Because in that debate, we've reached the point where evidence and arguments are no longer the heart of the matter. In considering the rejection of basic textbook biology by a large fraction of the US population, a good analogy that we might draw is with the phenomenon of jury nullification. So juries in criminal trials, sometimes for reasons that look good in retrospect, and sometimes for reasons that look bad in retrospect, occasionally find a verdict that is entirely at odds with the evidence before them. They simply refuse to follow the path that the court expects them to follow. Do they believe that the defendant is innocent? I think some might not, but I think in many cases the term belief is too blunt an instrument to capture what's going on. Now, switching to the case of evolution, many people in the US have decided that textbook Darwinism is an integral part of a package of ideas that they simply refuse to take on board. It is too much a negation of their hopes and orientation towards life. Another presentation of the arguments, another demonstration that we can see evolution by natural selection occurring in laboratory populations will not make much difference. They simply reject the larger package. Now, one thing that we can do in a situation like this is try to loosen up people's views of the package that they dislike, and so that ideas about evolution and human ancestry don't seem quite so closely tied to questions about morality and hope. And that's, of course, a philosophical project. Now, there's no point in trying to loosen the package beyond certain natural ties, however. There's no point in pretending that certain strongly teleological views about human life go well together with our current scientific understanding, because they don't. Another approach is to try to outline a different view of how life can make overall sense. Now, this can devolve into a kind of saccharine boosterism, especially when it mimics too closely the form of the old views of life's purpose that people are trying to replace. What is needed is somehow to give people a different shape for a view of how they fit into the universe. And I think of one way of doing that is trying to enable people to see the world as open with possibility rather than bound up with duty and purpose. Okay, that was all by way of introduction, and now I will talk about distribution explanations and origin explanations. Okay, the theoretical part of Darwinism has two parts. One is the postulation of the tree of life, a tree-shaped structure of common ancestry. The second is the theory of evolution by natural selection, a theory of how change occurs on individual branches or segments of the tree. Now, here's a three-part summary of evolution by natural selection, which is modeled on summaries often given biologists. We can say evolution by natural selection is change in a population due to variation in the characteristics of members of the population, which causes differential rates of reproduction or differential reproductive output, and which is inherited. We can also express this with a recipe or a conditional. We can say if there is a population in which there is variation in some characteristic and the variation is inherited, and if some of the variant traits lead to individuals having an advantage in reproduction, then the population will change over time. An if-then. The traits that lead some organisms to have more offspring than others will tend to become more common in many cases. Now, saying it like this is using a simple verbal formula. In special cases, the conditions that I've just expressed can be met without change resulting. And when one wants more detail about what will happen, a formal model is more appropriate than a verbal summary. But the verbal summaries do capture how the process works. The variation that fuels a process such as this need not be random, or, as it is often more carefully put, undirected. So variation is undirected if the production of new variation is not pushed one way or the other by the organism's needs or circumstances. Now, that might be how things are. Alternatively, there might be some bias. But as Darwin supposed and as basic genetics confirms, a great deal of variation is undirected in this sense. The theory is also associated often with a kind of outside-in pattern of explanation, in which environmental factors are the ones that direct change. Now, certainly environments matter, but any difference between organisms, including matters of pure internal efficiency that make for a reproductive advantage, can suffice. Okay. So I'll next introduce the distinction between kinds of explanations that will be central to this talk, and some relevant references and precursors are there on the slide. The distinction is applicable in both Darwinian contexts and other contexts. And I'll call the distinction between distribution explanations and origin explanations, where this terminology is modelled in part on an earlier distinction due to Karen Neander. So when we give a distribution explanation, biological or non-biological, we assume the existence of a set of variants in some population or collection, and we explain why they have the distribution they do, or why their distribution has changed. So some of the variants might be common while others are rare, some may have been lost from the population while being present at an earlier time. A distribution explanation explains facts of that kind. An origin explanation, in contrast, is directed on the fact that the population has come to contain individuals of a certain kind at all. It doesn't matter how many there are, and it doesn't matter which individuals are the individuals of that kind. The point of the explanation is just to explain how there came to be some rather than none. So now we are giving an explanation of the original appearance of variants that are taken for granted when giving a distribution explanation. Now, almost everybody agrees that natural selection can be used to give distribution explanations. It can be used to explain why a characteristic is common or rare, for example. The blue individuals might get eaten by predators more often than the green ones, and if colour is heritable, that can change the distribution of colours in the population. The more controversial matter is whether and how natural selection can figure in origin explanations. Now, an obvious thing that we might say at this point is that selection has no role in origin explanations per se. Selection has to do with sorting things that already exist. So that process cannot possibly bring new things into being. Now, that would not mean that evolutionary biology as a whole could not explain origins. Instead, it would show that origin explanations are given by a different part of the overall package of factors that biology recognizes. So origin explanations, we might say, are then given in terms of what we now call mutation, along with the recombination of characteristics through sex. So perhaps one should say at this point that modern Darwinism contains a package, and mutation is the creative part of the package. Selection is the distribution explainer, while mutation is the origin explainer. Hugo de Vries, an important biologist at the turn of the 20th century, expressed a view like this in a 1909 commemoration of Darwin's achievement. Okay, I'm not going to read out the entire quote. The most important parts are at the beginning and the end. So de Vries says, "It should be pointed out here that in order to be selected, a change must first have been produced. And then down the bottom, natural selection acts as a sieve. It does not single out the best variations, but it simply destroys the larger number of those which are, from some cause or another, unfit for their present environment. And here he is again in an earlier work. He says, with the single steps of evolution, natural selection has nothing to do. Only after the step has been taken, the sieve acts, eliminating the unfit. The problem as to the manner in which the individual steps are brought about is quite another side of the question. So de Vries saw Darwin's achievement as part of a larger picture that was only just becoming clear when he was writing, around 1909. All that Darwin could do was study observable tendencies in the production of new variations and tentatively postulate a process in which they are brought about by shocks to the reproductive system. By 1909, when de Vries was writing, the new science of genetics was adding the missing elements. So the modern usage of the word mutation was introduced by de Vries, and as he saw it, it was only well after Darwin, and in large part through de Vries' own work, that the origin of what he calls the individual steps in evolution was becoming clear. Now, de Vries himself had a saltationist view of evolution. He thought that substantial change can occur in large jumps, whereas Darwin emphasized gradual change. But even with very small steps, de Vries might say, it is still true that in order to be selected, a change must first have been produced. So that basic point is unaffected by the size of the steps. Now, some of what de Vries says here, I think, makes good sense. It's true that in order to be selected, a change must first have been produced. So again, why not just say that selection is a distribution explainer and mutation is an origin explainer? But that's not the whole story. Selection has a role in origin explanations as well. So selection is not an immediate or a proximate cause of a new variant. The most important immediate causes of new variants are mutation and recombination, and from now on I will just be talking about mutation. But selection can reshape a population in a way that makes a given variant more likely to be produced through the immediate sources of variation than it would otherwise be. Selection does this by changing the background against which the immediate sources of variation operate. And this change is what those immediate sources of variation can produce. In particular, selection can make a new characteristic more likely to be produced by making intermediate stages on the road to that new characteristic common rather than rare. And this greatly increases the number of ways in which a rare mutation can suffice to produce the characteristic in question. So I'll give a very simple illustration. Suppose we are explaining the evolution of something like the human eye. Now, in my diagram here, I'm assuming that there's asexual reproduction and humans are sexual, but suppose it's an eye-like structure in an asexual organism. Building the genetic basis of this thing involved bringing together a great number of genes. So consider a collection of genetic material, which we can call X, that has everything needed as far as building an eye goes, except for one final mutation. So this background is such that if a particular final mutation arises against that background, then you get the eye. Now, initially, X must have been rare in the population. It was the product of a single mutational event that produced X from yet another precursor, W. Selection can then make the appearance of the eye more likely by making X more common. This increases the number of independent slots in which a single mutational event will suffice to give us the eye. If the intermediate X remains rare in the population, then additional mutations are much less likely to produce the eye, because the right mutation has to occur in exactly the right place, in one of the few lineages where X happens to be present. Okay, here we have just looked at the last step and have also told the story running backwards from a characteristic of interest. The process itself runs forwards without foresight and involves a great many of these steps. So what's needed is for many intermediaries, X, W before X, and so on before that, to be favored and hence made common. This makes the eye accessible to mutation in a way that would not be, in a way that would not be without the favoring of intermediates. It's worth taking a few moments to, I think, emphasize and sort of just go over explicitly the non-teleological character of this process. So when we call something an intermediate or a precursor, this term only applies in retrospect, and its being a precursor has no role in the process itself. So if someone is suspicious, we can say everything we have to say without using a term like that. So we have a population at time t. It contains variation. Some traits are useful to the organisms that bear them, and some are not. They're useful for what they are like now at time t, not for what they might lead to in the future. The useful ones increase because of their effect on reproduction. Their increase creates many separate experiments, many sites at which further new things may arise. Now, whatever is favored at time t, that will affect the later experiments at t plus 1 because it will change the background in which mutations appear. The starting points for future rounds of mutation will be different from what they would have been if some other trait had been favored at time t or if there'd been no fitness differences at time t at all. So if something is favored at time t, that will change the range of variants that arise at t plus 1. Some of these might also be better than others and increase, and that will affect what is then produced at t plus 2. This goes on indefinitely without foresight. Sometimes, often, it leads nowhere that strikes us as noteworthy, but sometimes it produces eyes and brains. One way this happens is when new traits produced at each stage of the process do a little better than their precursors, their predecessors, at seeing, thinking, camouflaging, or attracting mates. So origin explanations include distribution explanations. Changes to distributions affect what originates later. Selection can then be a creative force, even though it's true in every case that, quote, in order to be selected, a change must first have been produced, as de Vries put it back in 1909. What de Vries did not see is that the production of a change can be made more likely when selection has altered the background against which the immediate causes of variation operate. So he did not see the importance of cumulative selection. Now, you might say at this point that the biological story told is okay, but it is not selection itself that does any of the creating or originating. The creating is still due to mutation. And at this point, we reach a partly verbal issue, not entirely, which I would resolve as follows. So we can make a three-way comparison. We can compare mutation alone, selection alone, and mutation and the right kind of selection together. Selection alone cannot produce new things, though it can keep the good ones that are around now. Mutation alone can produce new things, but it does so in an indiscriminate way. Almost all of what results will be junk, and the capacity to even stay alive will be slowly degraded. There's almost no chance of producing things like eyes and brains. Selection and mutation together can produce eyes and brains. So when we're explaining eyes and brains, you can say it's the package that's creative, but you should also then say that selection is as creative as mutation is. And from that it follows that the view that selection is the distribution explainer and mutation is the origin explainer, an intuitive view, it follows from what I said that that view is false. So just saying it again even more simply, the simplest possible way to put it would be something like this. The role played by selection is as follows. If you can get to C easily from B, but with difficulty from A, then you can make C more likely to arise by having lots of B around rather than A. As Patrick Forber has noted, given how genetic systems work, in a biological context, the simple schematism I just described usually requires that trait C be the product of many genes, or at least a lot of DNA, a long sequence. To the extent that something can arise complete as a unit through a single change, whose probability is largely independent of the background in which new changes arise, selection is only a sorter. So suppose there is a genetic locus in humans where the DNA sequence is CGT for everybody right now. And if a particular mutation arose that changed the middle G to an A, suddenly we would get something quite different. Now, the chance of that happening is not much affected by the fact that we have a C on one side and a T on the other. Now, in some cases, the neighboring nucleotides can have an effect, but only a small one. Then, if the middle G changes to an A and we get a new kind of human, the way that selection has shaped the nucleotides around it will not be much relevant to the origination event. You can't use selection to give an origin explanation there. Now, that's a possible situation, but it's not how things usually are for traits like eyes and brains. These are the products of lots of DNA, and the effect of any new mutation in one of them is greatly affected by the DNA around them, by the background in which the mutation arises. So returning to this minimal case, suppose that the great evolutionary novelty will only arise if both the C is replaced by a T and the middle G is replaced by an A. Then selection can change the chances of getting the novelty, provided one or the other of those two changes is favourable in its own right. Okay, so that's how I'm thinking about the role of selection in distribution explanations. And something that follows quickly from this is not all Darwinian processes have the capacity to give rise to otherwise improbable new characteristics in this way. Not all selection has the kind of power I'm describing. This fact, I think, is important in the history of biology. So looking at the history, Darwin had two kinds of precursors. There were some who anticipated the idea of natural selection, and there were some who anticipated the idea of a tree of life, a tree-shaped pattern of common ancestry. There were many more of the former than the latter. Those who speculated about variation and selection as a biological process included ancients such as Lucretius and Empedocles, various Enlightenment thinkers such as Diderot, and a number of minor 19th century figures. So a lot of people had seen the basic idea of variation and selection and had not done much with it. This is in part because many of the stories told involve just one round in principle of variation and selection, and these include the cosmologies of Empedocles and Lucretius. So they both posited a special period in which variation was produced, followed by a period of culling of the monsters. And the forms that were not culled are the forms that we see today. So in Empedocles, for example, the initial raw material is supposed to have been a collection of separate parts of complex organisms, parts such as eyes and hands. These came together to form combinations. Most of them were monstrous, but a few of them were viable, and that's what gave rise to us. On the slide there, I have a quote from Lucretius expressing a similar sort of one-time variation selection episode. Another example involves a more unexpected precursor. So the most important evolutionary theorist before Darwin was Lamarck, famous now for the idea of evolution by the inheritance of acquired characteristics. Lamarck did not think that part of his theory was original to him. He thought it was well known. And his remark on this point, I think, is one of the great ironies of the history of science. So Darwin in the Crucial Passage, Lamarck in the passage notes first that a version of his view exists as a proverb, the proverb, habits form a second nature. And then Lamarck says, if the habits and nature of each animal could never vary, the proverb would have been false and would not have come into existence, nor been preserved in the event of anyone suggesting it. This was a tiny piece of Darwinian reasoning, the idea that proverbs are sort of are sort of suggested idly and the good ones are kept and the bad ones are thrown out. So Lamarck embedded a tiny piece of Darwinian reasoning, cultural Darwinism in fact, within one of his central defences of the main Darwinian non-Darwinian mechanism. But of course Lamarck's, like Lucretius's and Empedocles, is just a one-step application of the idea of variation and selection. So these are all the Lucretius, Empedocles and Lamarck case. They're all genuine but shallow Darwinian explanations. If there's just one turn of the cycle, there's no role for selection to play in explaining the origination of new structures, only in the culling of what's already present. So one way a Darwinian process can be important is giving origin explanations. But this is not the only way. A lot of evolutionary biology now is concerned with giving distribution explanations that are informative in their own right. So using these ideas, I think we can describe a difference between Darwin's Darwinism and the neo-Darwinism or modernized Darwinism of the synthetic theory, which I understand as including current views. So in Darwin's work, the emphasis is on origin explanations. The distribution explanations that Darwin gives are very simple explanations. They're merely explanations of the proliferation or loss of a variant. So something appears and it either spreads or is lost. The accumulation of those events explains how new kinds of organisms come to exist, and that's the great goal of the work. In the synthetic theory of the 1930s and onwards, the possibility of giving far more sophisticated distribution explanation arises, and that's made possible by Mendelian genetics. So in writers like Fisher and Wright, we see the idea of a discrete particle, a gene, inherited intact over large numbers of generations, coming into new combinations with other genes by definite rules and becoming more or less frequent in the gene pool. Now, once you have that a sense of that particle, it makes a very different kind of work possible. For example, going back even before people like Fisher and Wright, one of the very first questions addressed using both Darwinism and Mendelism together was the question, can a tiny fitness advantage of the order of 1% produce any significant change? So this was investigated by George Yule in the first years of the 20th century. And the answer, which was not obvious ahead of time, was yes. Now this question could not be answered, but I think could not really even be coherently asked in Darwin's time. The difference between 1% and 10% is something that in Darwin's framework is not a sort of usable distinction. And that was not because of Darwin's assumptions about inheritance and the role of blending, but because no framework was in place within which it could be formulated and investigated. From the 1930s onwards, there are detailed formal models of how gene and genotype frequencies change, and these are all schemata for giving very complicated distribution explanations. But the basic idea that Darwin saw regarding origin explanations is still intact. It's not always obviously visible in work done in the recent modelling tradition, partly because of the intrinsic appeal of giving ever more sophisticated distribution explanations, but it's there. Modern evolutionary theory can give us both kinds of explanations. Okay, that was the end of a historical part digression. And now, in this last section of the talk, I'm going to look more closely at origin explanations. So if we imagine a complete causal story about an evolving population, there will be a collection of individuals, some of them similar to each other, some dissimilar. Each has a total combination of characteristics. These, plus the environments that they encounter, determine how the individual's life goes. Some differences in their traits affect how well they do in comparison with each other, and some don't. So we get a sort of total story, all the lives and deaths, all the causal roles of traits in producing success or failure at reproduction, and so on. There's a total story, but descriptions and models of evolution that we actually give will, of course, focus on some of these features and not others. And they will tend to abstract away from the detail in different ways. What I'll talk about in this section is the idea that the way that selection is often described, both formally in models, informally in verbal descriptions and in metaphors, is often more in line with the distribution explanation side of things than the origin explanation side. Now, why is that? Not, I think, because people think origin explanations are unimportant. I think people sometimes don't realize that the forms of description that they're giving do make a difference here. So some of the choices that are convenient are ones that fit well with the distribution explanation side of things, not the origin explanation side. And these can make origin explanations hard to see. Now, there are several of these, three or four. In this talk, I'll just be talking about one or two of the more important ones. Okay, first, in biology, selection is often described as a comparative matter. So if we have two types, A and B, in a population, and we say that A is favored by selection over some period, this does not usually have to do with how well A is doing in absolute terms, but with how well it is doing in relation to B. It's a comparative judgment that we're making. Roberta Milstein, in a recent paper, gives an explicit statement of this view, but the point is not controversial. It's seen in the fact that most of the accounting in evolutionary biology is done in terms of the relative frequencies of a gene or a trait in a population. Now, for some special purposes, the absolute numbers are taken to matter. So if people are looking at drift, random change in small populations, then absolute numbers matter, and questions about extinction are certainly affected by questions about absolute numbers. But for many purposes, all that's taken to matter when thinking about selection is frequencies. Now, considering first distribution explanations, is this the right approach? Well, there I think it's essentially a matter of choice, whether relative or absolute numbers are the focus. You can think in terms of either. You might want to include information about absolute numbers or not. Thinking in terms of frequencies achieves a kind of compression of information that might be desirable. But things are different in the case of origin explanations. So earlier I told a story about the evolution of the eye. I said that the probability of the eye arising was raised when selection favors a precursor, X, that is one mutational step away from the eye. But what mattered in that story was changing the absolute number of backgrounds that were of the right type. The probability of the eye arising in a population in one step depends on the absolute number of the appropriate sites or experiments that are going on where a final mutation might do the job, not on how numerous those appropriate backgrounds are in relation to the inappropriate ones. So if by the word selection we mean a change in relative frequencies due to some reproductive advantage, then selection is only important in origin explanations when it affects absolute numbers in the right way. I should add that Tim Lewins also makes this point in his first book. So suppose we have a population with some eye precursors and some non-precursors, and we say that selection can make the eye more common by making the precursors more common. Sorry, selection can make the eye more likely by making the precursors more common and the non-precursors less common. But the same effect could be achieved by increasing the numbers of all types. So a global increase in which frequencies don't change is just as good as selection favoring the eye precursor. Similarly, the sort of flip side of that case, there are ways in which selection favoring the precursor could decrease the chances of the eye arising. So suppose you have a population with some precursors and some non-precursors, and some environmental change occurs which introduces selection that now favors the precursors. The precursors are doing better than the others. But this environmental change, the kind of selection it is reducing, let's suppose, the absolute numbers of all types. So the precursor is becoming more common relative to its rivals, but less common absolutely. That's a case in which introducing selection favoring the precursor can reduce the probability of evolving the eye. So when we care about origin explanations, we can't choose to ignore absolute numbers as we can, if we want to, in distribution explanations. When selection has a role in origin explanations, this is because of how absolute numbers are affected. We can return here to de Vries back in 1909, and also to a well-known discussion by Elliot Sober from the 1980s. So de Vries, as we saw, compared natural selection to a sieve. A sieve is a filter. It distinguishes between some pre-existing things, allowing some through and keeping others behind. Elliot Sober, in his 1984 book on natural selection, compared natural selection to a toy that acts as also as a sieve or filter. Now, this analogy is okay in some context, and it's okay for the purposes that Sober had in mind in his discussion, but not okay in all contexts. So in the case of natural selection, the favoured individuals do not merely make it through the filter, they also, having made it through, increase, multiply, become more numerous. Natural selection is a magnifier or an amplifier as much as it is a filter. It's useful here to return to the Ernst Haeckel picture that I used as the front piece for this talk. So Haeckel's picture is an evolutionary analogue of the Horn of Plenty image. And here, Haeckel is emphasising the multiplication, the increase in numerosity that is characteristic of biological systems. In selection, the favoured expand just as the disfavoured contract. Now, once you describe selection as an amplifier rather than a filter, questions about origin explanations become a lot clearer. If you amplify the numbers of some of the ones who exist now, those will become the basis for the next round of change, and that will affect what arises downstream. Okay, continuing that thread, but introducing an extra element. In Darwin's 19th century descriptions of natural selection, what he referred to as the struggle for life was made central. Organisms live in a world of scarce resources and must compete for them. In more recent writing about natural selection, the idea of a struggle for life is often seen as inessential, perhaps even a little misleading. So in recent writing, people often say, it's true that resources are often scarce in fact, but the basic idea of change through differences in reproductive capacity does not require any sort of struggle. So the struggle idea is often now seen as an idea that Darwin got from Thomas Malthus's pessimistic essay on population, published at the end of the 18th century. This helped Darwin develop his view, it's now thought, but the struggle for life was then made too central by Darwin to evolutionary thinking and some other writers at this time, you know, perhaps in part because of his Victorian context or just the psychological spur that was provided in Darwin's own development by reading Malthus's essay. So here, for example, is Richard Lewontin writing in one of his summaries of what evolution by natural selection involves. Lewontin says, "Competition between organisms for a resource in short supply is not integral to the argument. Natural selection occurs even when two bacterial strains are growing logarithmically in an excess of nutrient broth if they have different division times." So no need to suppose competition for scarce resources. Tim Lewins, in another one of his books, the Darwin book, says something similar. He says that modern evolutionary theory has, quote, no essential commitment to the Malthusian view that lies at the heart of Darwin's theory. Now, again, I suggest that the issue looks different across the context of distribution and origin explanations. So suppose I have two offspring and you have one offspring. So I have more offspring than you. But it may or may not be the case that my having two offspring rather than one prevented you from having two offspring rather than one. There may or may not be a causal dependence between my reproductive output and yours, so that a slot that I fill in the next generation is a slot that you can't fill. When that sort of causal relation is present, then if I am successful, it implies not just higher numbers than you, but higher numbers than I would have had if selection had not been favouring me. Selective competition is only important to origin explanations insofar as the winner is able to produce more absolute numbers of offspring than it would otherwise. This we saw above. Then we ask, what is it that produces this kind of causal dependence between reproductive success of different individuals? And the answer is that, roughly speaking, it is scarce resources. It's what Darwin called the struggle for life. So I said above, at the end of the previous subsection, that selection is as much an amplifier as a filter. Don't think that the filter metaphor is superior to a metaphor such as amplification. When I say selection is as much an amplifier as a filter, that claim depends on assumptions about resources and populations. So what's known as the carrying capacity for a population is the maximum number of individuals that its environment can support. If you make no assumptions about scarcity and about where the population numbers are, then filters and amplifiers are very different things. Filters reduce and amplifiers increase, and either of those things may happen on its own. That's true if the environment is congenial. So, for example, if numbers are small and the population is far from its carrying capacity, as was the case with rabbits soon after European settlement in Australia, then many rabbit traits may be amplified in absolute terms. So you'll have a situation where the best strains are growing fastest, but the less best strains are also, in many cases, growing as well. You have differential amplification, but not as much filtering. If the population is above carrying capacity for some reason, then there will be much more filtering and much less amplifying. So the worst will be lost, but the best may well decline as well. Now, in many actual cases, populations cannot grow much, but there is no reason for them to shrink either. So many populations are thought to be close to carrying capacity. When that's true, the simple relationship between absolute numbers and relative numbers that I was describing above will hold. There'll be a zero-sum relationship, such that for one type to increase, another must decrease. Relative success will imply absolute success. It implies it in this sense. When a type is favoured by selection, there come to be more individuals of that type in absolute terms than there would be if the type had not been favoured. That type is being amplified and other types are being filtered out. So we saw earlier two cases where relative success came apart from the kind of absolute success that matters in origin explanations. So in one, the population was growing. All types were increasing, and this increase made a given novelty more accessible to mutation, even though the intermediate step was not being selectively favoured relative to others. In the second case, the population was shrinking, and relative success was not sufficient. So an intermediate was being favoured in relative terms, but that did not imply an increase of that type in absolute terms. If the population is near carrying capacity, neither growing nor shrinking, then relative success implies absolute success and vice versa. Here I think it's helpful just sort of perhaps one more time to go back to sort of the very popular sieve-type images that people like, De Vries back in 1909, Sober in the 1980s have made popular. There's no reproduction in a system like this. If all the balls are starting at the top, with stages as generations and being sorted successively as they move through the system, then at the end, we have a much smaller population than we had before. The big ones have not made it through, but the smaller ones have not taken their place. They have not multiplied to occupy the space in the environment that the big ones once occupied. So we need to insert something like Haeckel's picture with its theme of multiplication to capture what is both the usual case and the case where relative success has a role in origin explanations because relative success is implying absolute success. So, just to sum up quickly, so the argument is that the important features of natural selection in the context of origin explanations are not the same as those that are important for distribution explanations. The general picture, which is illustrated here, and also in some cases that I haven't talked about in this talk, is that if you are only interested in giving distribution explanations, then you have a number of free choices with respect to what kinds of abstractions you engage in, what kind of information you throw away. In the context of origin explanations, there is less choice. People often describe selection in a way that is convenient, but more appropriate for distribution explanations. And a simple example is doing all the accounting with frequencies. And I think perhaps this helps explain why it has often not been clear to people that selection has the role in origin explanations that, in fact, it does. Thanks.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.